Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
It's not just your business. It's 10 years of planning, saving, and risk-taking. It's not just another order. It's a chance to gain a loyal customer. It's not just a box. It's how they'll remember you. And Staples Connect isn't just a store. It's where you'll find innovative tools your small business needs, like premium shipping supplies to give your customers a one-of-a-kind unboxing experience. Explore what's new at your local Staples store or at staplesconnect.com. Staples Connect, the working and learning store.
Motherly's 2021 State of Motherhood survey just came out. We've been doing this study for quite a few years, and every year the results are staggering. But this year, in the wake of a pandemic, it is clear that American motherhood is in crisis. Our survey results revealed that 93% of mothers feel burned out. And that is up 7 points from last year's survey. So that happened right before the pandemic hit. There are so many social and structural factors, but the clear reality is that American mothers are not thriving. And whether you're talking about their mental health, the support they have or don't have in their homes, the pressures they face, it's a crisis moment. And a core and foundation of helping mothers be well is centralizing and prioritizing their own mental health. We cannot thrive as mothers without having our own mental health, our own well-beings prioritized. So if you are one of the 93%, you are not alone. There are many women, including one of our guests today, a very prominent woman who you probably know well. You may even have some of her products in your home. Even she is feeling the burnout. Hey, Mama, welcome to the Motherly Podcast, where we have very honest conversations about modern motherhood. I am Liz Tennedy, the co-founder of Motherly, and I am a mother of four myself. This month, we're focusing on a critical issue that we know is impacting mothers' lives probably more than ever, and that is mental health. This week, we're diving deep into a mental health conversation with Melissa Bernstein. So you know her from the toy brand Melissa and Doug. She is one of the most successful toy businesses and entrepreneurs of her generation. And yet, while you may be familiar with the incredible toys that Melissa has designed, you might not know that Melissa has suffered from debilitating depression her whole life, which she writes about in her new book, Lifelines. Melissa shared her story with me, and her big message is that if you are suffering from mental health challenges for whatever reason, you are not alone. Melissa Bernstein, welcome to the Motherly Podcast.
Thank you. I am so honored to be here.
We're honored to have you. You're a big deal, not just in the parenting world, but in my house with four kids who love your toys. So we're really, really excited to have you on. I always like to begin with a question just about our guest and parenting. So you're a mother of six. You are also one of the most influential toy designers in the world, which has had ripple effects on millions of childhoods. So I'm curious, reflecting on your personal life and your professional life, what do you think makes your approach to motherhood and interacting with children unique?
I mean, the essence of everything I've done with Melissa and Doug rests on open-ended play and the power of unleashing our imaginations and giving kids a childhood that allows them to explore and really figure out why they're here, what their talents are, what they love to do, so they can engage in that and lead a fulfilling life. And I think as a mom, all we did was explore that boundless expanse of imagination every single day.
But there were six of them. So how did that not just descend into chaos? I ask as a mother of four.
So we did a lot, honestly, together. And I think it wasn't a lot of individual time. And as I say, I've been such a perfectionist at so many times in my life. And I think with motherhood, I basically just tried to do the best I could and had to be okay with that, because if I got too much in my head, I would destroy myself. So that became my mantra, just do the best you can and care enough and be intentional.
So you've written a new book called Lifelines. We're going to talk a lot about it today, but you brought up perfectionism, which is certainly a theme within your book. So I am really curious. I mean, so many women in our culture identify with being perfectionists, and there's so many pressures on women and girls. We arrive to motherhood as practiced perfectionists, and motherhood and perfectionism are not compatible. And I wonder, how did it stretch you? How did it challenge you? And what did it teach you to accept all that is not within your control within motherhood?
An amazing question. And perfectionism and martyrdom have been the biggest scourges of my life. And I think the ones that resonate the most with women. And they were really intertwined. Being a martyr, which is someone who serves others to find validation and to be perfect in their eyes, became my mode of behaving from a little girl on, to be valued, to not irk others' ire, and to not get them mad at me. I basically did whatever I could to please. And that behavior, and it was my validation and a form of perfectionism, carried through my life into motherhood and the need to be perfect myself and not show anything other than that shiny face and to serve others no matter what their needs were, when they were. And it ultimately became serving from this empty well and really left me very bitter and resentful. I didn't know any differently then. And I think I've learned so much. The one thing that I think I did reasonably well when it came to perfection was I always knew from a little girl that I wanted both. I wanted to be really successful and have a great career, and I desperately wanted to have children. And I knew they were both essential for my well-being, that I needed something outside of the children to make me feel whole and give my life meaning, and I needed children to just bring my life joy. And from the beginning, I was very intentional about showing my kids how important my job was. And I've talked to so many women that feel such guilt over working because mainly they don't want to be working. They really want to be home with their children, but they have to work to put food on the table. And they're very angry, guilty, and resentful about that. And unfortunately, they communicate that to their children.
Right.
And they communicate that to their job. When they're at their job, they're always really upset they have to be there and they're like racing to get home. And when they're home, they feel like they didn't give enough to their job and the job's calling them. And it's this constant battle that they face. And from the beginning, I knew that I am going to make certain that my kids know that they're important, but how much I desperately need and love my job. Mm-hmm. And there were some really tough times in there, but I will say that I think it really was a very good role model for my kids because today, you know, I have four daughters and two sons, and there isn't one of them that doesn't talk about combining both motherhood and work. And they never think that they can't do both. And although it was very messy, there was no balance. There were days that I was like hyperventilating because I didn't have enough time in the day to give everyone what they needed. I never showed them that I couldn't do both and I wasn't going to be intentional about doing both and that I cared deeply about both.
Okay, there's a lot to follow up on there, but I do want to get at a question that I have as we're unpacking all of this. What was your childhood like? I mean, a lot of the book that you wrote is talking about these forces within you, habits, ways of being that have been with you your whole life. And I'm curious, as someone whose legacy is about making childhood magical, how would you describe it?
My childhood was absolutely terrifying. It was not an idyllic childhood. And I think not for any fault but my own chemistry. I was born with a lot of darkness and a voice in my head that basically told me life was meaningless and to end my life because anything I could do to make meaning would be in vain. Mm. So I lived with this real demon in my head.
So when did it start?
I believe it started from the moment I took my very first breath because my mother truly said for the first year of my life, I cried 24/7. And it wasn't normal cries of colic. It was cries of like, she said she was terrified. The cries were so violent. And I think I really, from the moment I was born, kind of pondered three questions. You know, why am I here? What is the meaning of life if we are all ultimately just going to expire? And what am I meant to do during my brief time here? And because, of course, at age 1, 2, 3, you can't voice those questions, much less get concrete answers to them. I lived with this utter sense of futility toward existence. Like I didn't understand why everyone else seemed to be happy and that they were going through life, you know, engaging in just fun, where I was like, did I come here from another planet? Like someone plot me here. And I can't understand why people are acting like everything's fine when everything is not fine. And I think there were only two ways really of dealing with that. You know, one was when I could, I retreated to my imagination and that became my happy place because my imagination was fertile ground. It was a white expanse of possibility that I was utterly in control of. And I really fabricated my own world. I wrote incessant verses. I wrote music and really just anything was possible there. But when I had to be in real life with people, I unfortunately ended up denying, repressing, and disassociating everything I felt in order to survive and kind of anchoring to pleasing, to perfectionism, and to performance as my method to gain acceptance and validation. Because who I was, which was a really hypersensitive, odd, creative person, was definitely not accepted by the society in which I lived.
So how did toy design ultimately fit into this unique personality type that you were born with?
It wasn't intentional by any means. And I think, you know, when Doug and I decided to step off society's conventional treadmill, because we were on that treadmill to begin with, and he always jokes that we conceived a toy company out of wedlock. Because we formed Melissa and Doug when we were just dating. I met him when I was 19 and I was at the lowest of lows in my life. I had a massive, terrible eating disorder and weighed like 80 pounds. In some ways, he saved me because although we never talked about the feelings, he really forced me to eat and to please him because I was a pleaser and it was a battle between the pleaser in me and the demon in my head. And the pleaser, thank goodness, won out. And I started eating. But then once I sort of got healthy enough to finish school and all that, we decided to get off that treadmill, which was really unfulfilling and unsatisfying, and start doing something on our own. And really just by luck, we decided to start a toy company. I mean, it was destined because all four of our parents were in education and we loved children. But the idea of making tangible toys was kind of just a brainstorm. And I think it was utter shock and elation when I realized that I had the ability to just kind of create toys. It wasn't like I ever took a toy design course or any design course. I never thought of myself as a creative or a designer, but just those hypersensitivities also enabled me to come up with toys. Mm-hmm. So it was very cool when I realized that I could channel this darkness and despair into something as light and bright as toys. It was the most miraculous experience of my life because I truly felt like I could breathe for the very first time. And making toys has been such an incredible salvation for me. That was the first sense of agency I had over myself, that I could choose in which direction my creativity flowed. And I thought, you know what? This is going to be my life. And I wrote the mantra, step on out of the head, moving into the heart, free to channel all dread into jubilant art. And that jubilant became my decision to channel the dread into something light and bright, like a toy.
Was there something that you think was unique about your perspective on play and childhood that, you know, decades later is still changing kids' lives? What do you think that maybe you uniquely saw? At that point, you weren't even a mother. What was the insight or gift that you were bringing to Melissa and Doug at the very beginning?
So it's the same philosophy that I've had through everything my entire life. And it's the very philosophy that makes me write my verses, which, by the way, are very, very simple. And it's basically my philosophy that everything should be simplified to its pure essence, because it's when it's its purest essence that we can truly experience the joy of it. And we tend to overcomplicate everything in life. And when we overcomplicate things, we end up taking things that are supposed to be in the heart and bringing them to the head. I decided to channel that exact same philosophy into toys and basically say, because toys in the day that we started making toys were very complicated.
They're still complicated today. I mean, the fact that so many of our products are really made with wood or heavy materials that feel substantive. I mean, my husband last week was like, I am not ever buying another plastic toy. So it's 2021 and our world is still oversaturated with plastic as part of the kids' environment. But what are you trying to do by creating those kinds of just more substantive use that you call them simple? There's something about that open-ended play that I think that is really resonating with this generation of parents at the same time we got all the...
I mean, open-ended play is the essence of life. And it's basically saying that the toy you're using is not an end in itself. The toy you're using is purely a catalyst to unleash something incredible in that child. We always said our toys are 90% child, 10% toy. And the toy only works its magic once it unleashes that magic in the child that enables them to make something of it that you never would have even imagined. And, you know, I'll talk about like a chef role play costume. You know, if you put that on and you just walk around in it like it is, then it doesn't really work its magic if you just use it as a coat. But if you suddenly become a chef of a world famous restaurant in Paris and you create a name for that restaurant and you create a menu and you start preparing your pretend recipes, then it becomes uniquely yours. And that product becomes different for every single child that uses it, and even becomes different as that child grows up and uses it in a different way. So an open-ended toy is different no matter who uses it and no matter when you use it. And that's the beauty of it. And I think it's not having an ego, to be honest. So many people who are designers, it becomes about the design and about the look and about overly complicating it to become more than it actually is supposed to be. And when we do that, we take it out of the heart and we make it much more about the head, and it becomes less tangible and less relatable to regular people. Mm. And I think we wanted our toys to be accessible and to really bring that child a beautiful experience in their heart from the minute they engage with it.
Both you and your husband, Doug, love children, and you are a mother of six, of course, a toy designer, a poet as well. And I wonder if you think about what you love about children and what you've witnessed unfold in your own children, how has witnessing that and reliving childhood through those experiences influenced you in your mental health journey and your self-understanding and your search for meaning?
It's been really double-fold, unfortunately. I've witnessed the pure joy of seeing them engage with the natural world. And my son went from, well, he was the most avid collector with me, and we could spend 8 hours at the beach looking for that elusive gold nugget and the peals of joy that would come out of him, and that joy in seeing that sunset or the first star to grace the sky or jumping in a puddle. I love those beautiful, free wonders of nature that I think are essential for all of us to feel connected to our natural world and to connect with the extraordinary in the ordinary. So I've seen that beautiful discovery of the extraordinary in the ordinary. However, as they've grown, I've also seen the horrors of society and social pressures. And even my son now, you know, he's 13 and it's starting to leave him. And it's starting to not be cool to like go out with his mom and ponder how flowers are birds, or go in the garden and help me collect vegetables. We still do it. But like if his friend is over, like you better don't say anything about the sunset, mom. Mm-hmm. You know, and I see how the joy is almost like ripped out of us by society telling us it's not cool. So I think I've seen both sides of it, and it makes me very sad. And I'm a big fan of Dr. Stuart Brown, who wrote a book, Play, who we give to every new employee at Melissa and Doug. And basically, he was the first one, in my opinion, who said, if you do not adopt play in your life as a child, and then keep it in your life, your entire life, and hold on to it like it's the most precious thing, you will, by definition, fall into despair. Mm-hmm. And when I look at the world today, you know, 300 million depressed people, and it's an epidemic, I see it's because of isolation from people who accept us authentically, and it's lack of meaning in our lives because we've disconnected from anything that brings us joy.
Motherly does research each year called the State of Motherhood Survey. And, you know, they just confirm what you're saying. Our results are just coming out for this year about the state of despair within American motherhood in particular. And one missing component of the lives of most mothers is play and joy and pleasure. As someone who struggled openly and talking so much through your book about this existential depression, are there some examples of how you've tried to bring joy into your own life, even in those hard times? Joy, play, lightness, the freedom of childhood, the open-endedness that you're driving at with your toys, like things you reach for.
What I realized in taking my own journey inward, which was a long process, I realized that I need a daily and deliberate practice to remain steadfast, because being a highly excitable person and having all these hypersensitivities, I can really easily fall below the line. And that voice, interestingly, and I just experienced it in the last couple of weeks, because Lifelines has put a responsibility and a burden on me that I've never experienced in my life. I received over 10,000 letters after a piece I did, and had promised to respond to every single one personally. So my sense of responsibility was called into question. And I realized that if I don't engage in my form of self-care and joy, I will start to hear that voice again. And that's what happened. So I realized that this practice, it isn't a joke. So my practice exists of three areas. The first one is self-care. And when you are a martyr, and so many of the mothers I speak with and write me, self-care isn't even on the list. Mm-hmm. In fact, in my life, I believe self-care was selfish, was indulgent, and disallowed. I had what I call pleasure anorexia. Yeah. It wasn't just food. It was anything that brought me joy, because I believed I didn't deserve joy or self-care. So that might be the hardest category for me. It sounds so simple, but when you're a mom, and you, like, kids are in the shower with you, they're in the bathroom with you, they're in bed with you, like, you're not even thinking about self-care. But I now know it's essential. I've even changed the way I've termed it, mm-hmm. because I used to call it healthy eating, exercise, and sleep. Mm-hmm. And I now know that for someone who can become addicted to things really easily when I overdo it, healthy eating is not a good term, because what if I want something that's not healthy?
Right.
Then I'm like, you can't have that. It's not healthy. And then exercise. I became addicted to exercise for a long time in my life. Very dangerous. It's like a goal, mm-hmm. not the joy. And then sleep is another thing that when you're highly creative and you go into kind of a manic state and you have six children and you're running a business with 1,000 people, sleep to me was not something I wanted to do.
A waste of time, maybe?
It was a waste of time. And I was like, I'm going to try to sleep as little as I possibly can. But I now know that sleeping 3 hours a night for 3 weeks will put me in a really dark place. So I now call it body nourishment, body movement, and body rest. And for me, those make it like I'm taking care of myself versus pursuing another goal. Then the center section is tools and skills. And that's become my practice, my tools that I have to do each day. I go really high and I go really low. And I need that practice to like keep me sort of in the middle.
Mm-hmm.
And that includes a lot of things. It includes therapy once a week that I do no matter what, just to talk through things, make sure I'm on the right track, not go too extreme. I do mindfulness all the time. I offer myself self-compassion because I have this really angry voice and I don't allow myself to feel a lot of feelings. And it could be anything. Any tools that work in your backpack, so to speak, of lifelines should be there. And then the third area, which is what we were talking about, which is most important for me, is my passions and my play. And I have to be really deliberate about those two, because again, my tendency is to deny myself everything, mm-hmm. all three of those categories. I think about it as the battle between my head and my heart. My head is the prison. It's a very bad place. It's where all my despair emanated through this intellectual hypersensitivity. My heart just wants to be free, be liberated, and find peace. So anything that can get me from my head to my heart is beautiful. I have to walk for 1 hour in nature mm-hmm. every single day, no matter what the weather. I believe there's no such thing as bad weather, just bad outfits, mm-hmm. improper outfits. So I do that. I drink tea 3 times a day. Tea is really important to me. The warmth, the feeling of it, it grounds me. Like, and I hold on to this cup for dear life.
Well, I'm doing that too while you've been talking. So I thank you for validating that. I feel the same way. We don't talk enough about it. I don't know what magic is in my cup of tea, but it does make me feel all those things.
It's true. It's medicine.
Yes.
And for me, you know, my son was the first one. I just used to drink hot water because I didn't even think I deserved flavoring in it. And my beautiful son, he gave me a gift of tea that had like flavors in it. Loose leaf tea. And I was like, what is this? And I drank like a green tea with pomegranate. And I was like, oh my gosh, this is delicious. And I felt so indulgent. And he was like, Mom, you deserve to drink tea. And I was like, I was so sorry, a figure, you know, like I only deserve hot water. And now I don't care what's going on in my day. The first thing I do is, when am I going to walk? Or I will start to fall below the line.
These are many, many accessible ideas for ways to kind of put ourselves back on our to-do list. You brought up how one of your sons introduced you to tea and said, oh, you know, you might love this. And it's become a grounding practice for you to drink tea. I'm curious, you know, in the day-to-day living of motherhood, and also I think in the long term of how your kids interact with you and perceive you and your story, how has your depression, do you think, shaped the relationships with your children? And how have you tried to coach them through the journey you've been on alongside them growing up?
It's a really great question. And I'd say motherhood has been the most challenging journey of my life. And I often say to my closest friends, my personality composition really wasn't that conducive to having children because I'm so highly sensitive. And when someone says something that hurts me, it feels like a dagger has gone through my soul. And I would say one of my skills that has been the hardest for me to build is the ability to sit with others' pain. And one of my weaknesses as a mom, my greatest weaknesses, is when my kids would come to me, I immediately needed to fix them. And I think because my own situation was so dire, and if I succumbed to the darkness that enveloped me each day, I would have never come back.
Mm-hmm.
And I hadn't yet taken my own journey and learned to accept and tolerate my own despair. I couldn't tolerate theirs. Mm-hmm. So I was the mom that immediately, if they said something was wrong, I was like, okay, let's write down what you think happened and how we can rectify it. Mm-hmm. And then let's get on the path to changing it. And sometimes they would be like, Mom, I don't want to change it. Like, I'm sad. And I would be like, I know, but there's got to be a reason. There's got to be a way we can fix it. Mm. And I really had a hard time with that. And I think in many ways that was terrible for them because I was showing them one, it wasn't okay
right.
for them to feel the way they were feeling. And two, that it's just all about like moving on and fixing it and getting over it. So I've changed quite a bit and I've had to change quite a bit and sort of admit that I was emotionally stifled myself and made it so they felt that they couldn't share their deepest, darkest emotions with me either.
I'm curious at what points on your personal journey, your motherhood journey, you decided either to get help or those around you intervened or coached you into getting help. We are living through a global mental health crisis and people feel so much in despair and isolated. How did those kinds of interventions actually happen in your life?
You know, no one around me ever suggested I get help. And that's the problem of being a highly functioning depressed person who's really convincing too, is like I hid it from myself and I never would have said I needed help. I was the one who would, if someone said I needed help, I would have like bitten their head off. I would have been like, help? What are you talking about? I don't need help. Like, I'm fine. Because that was my battle cry and that was my validation. There was validation, such validation in being this martyr that was going to like bear through everything and find salvation in like being anointed a saint somewhere along the line. And I would even say to myself, like, I'm going to grin and get through this and I'm just going to be a survivor. So it was only when I reached middle age, and now I understand why they call it the midlife crisis, because it was only then that the pain that I had submerged and repressed my whole life, and then the resistance to all that pain was equaling such intense suffering, that dam that I had put up to hold it all back started to crack. And I reached such a state of exhaustion. And people say, I'm so exhausted. I'm just so utterly exhausted. And that's what it is. When you deny everything you're feeling and everything you are for decades, it is utterly exhausting. I mean, there's no other way to put it because you're not being yourself and you're hiding yourself. And that is so much more exhausting than just being who you are. So finally, I reached this point and it was like, I basically cracked and no one knew it. I mean, I knew it. And I basically like fell back, if you want to be dramatic, which I am. And I like was like, that's it. I give up. I surrender. I need help. You know, for me, asking for help equaled broken, flawed, weak.
For so many people in our culture, I mean, I want to say for women, but I think that's definitely also true for men. We have this idea of, especially in a time of social media, right? Of like putting it all out there with a happy face and always feeling like we have to be on and productive. So many people feel like they can't admit weakness, but it's interesting. Frankly, for someone as successful as you, the juxtaposition is not what people would expect.
And honestly, that might be my number one message. I think what I want people to know and see, and the reason I'm doing this, not enough people are saying, I have a mental affliction that I was born with and I will die with. Mm-hmm. And I, you know, have a chemical imbalance. That's just part of who I am. But that doesn't mean that I can't live a bountiful, productive, joy-filled life. I want to be proof to so many in despair who believe there's no hope and believe it's all or nothing. Well, I can't be despairing and still be happy sometimes. Yeah, you can. And actually, that is the very definition of being human. So all this crap that society has told us about, like, it's all about the pursuit of happiness and it's all about achieving these external measures of validation. And when you achieve them, you'll be happy and everything will be great. It's a lie. It's a myth. And we have to recognize that being human means we will all experience the ebbs and flows of life, which are the highest of highs and the lowest of lows, maybe within the same hour. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. I think that that's a really important message. And we will share more about the resources that you have created with Lifelines with our listeners and in the episode notes for this podcast. At Motherly, we believe that motherhood reveals or brings out our superpowers. And you have talked a lot, and we've all got to experience some of them. But I'm curious, what do you think deep down is your superpower?
To be authentic. You know, my superpower is to not hide a thing and to show life and reality and what it's like to be Melissa as it truly is, in hopes that it allows others to show their authentic selves as well.
Melissa Bernstein, thank you so much for sharing your story and joining us today on the Motherly Podcast.
Thank you, Liz. This was such a joy.
It's not just a box. It's a chance to gain a loyal customer. It's not just an office chair. It's why I'm able to play freeze tag with the kids after working 10 hours. And Staples Connect isn't just a store. It's where you'll find innovative tools for small business and remote workers, like premium shipping supplies that make a statement, and the All 33 Back Strong chair that'll make your body forget that you sat at your desk all day. Explore what's new at your local Staples store or at staplesconnect.com. Staples Connect, the working and learning store.
So my question is, what do you do when you feel sad?
I go to my mom, on my Aunt Pale, on my dad, and they help me.
Oh, how do they help you? What do they do?
They just make me feel better.
I'm happy that you said that. What's something that makes you feel happy?
When Mama snuggles me.
Well, that's it for our episode. Melissa, thank you so much for sharing your story with our listeners. And thank you for listening. Next week, we'll be talking to another guest about this critical topic around motherhood and mental health. As always, we would love it if you spread the word about the Motherly Podcast, including leaving us a review on Apple Podcasts. It takes 30 seconds, maybe even 15 if you do it quick. And it really helps others discover our show. And I love reading your feedback. The Motherly Podcast is produced by Jennifer Bassett with audio engineering from Seaplane Armada. Our music is from the Blue Dot Sessions. I am your host, Liz Tennedy. Thank you so much for listening.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.